But Ukraine's military says it's evacuating all remaining troops from their last stronghold in Mariupol, ceding control of the city to Russia. EU foreign ministers failed to reach an agreement on a proposed oil embargo against Russia over the war in Ukraine. And Iran's foreign minister condemns Israeli crimes against Palestinians and blames the regime for insecurity in the region. Thanks for joining us. The Russian president warns of a certain response if the U.S.-led NATO alliance deploys military infrastructure in Sweden and in Finland.
Finland, Sweden, I would like to inform you, dear colleagues, that Russia has no problems with these states. An expansion to these countries does not pose a direct threat to us, to Russia. But the expansion of military infrastructure to these territories will certainly provoke our response.
Vladimir Putin was reacting to Helsinki and Stockholm's decisions to become members of the Western Military Alliance. Putin said that Russia must look closely at what he called the alliance's plans to increase its global influence. On Monday, the Swedish government said it has formally decided to apply for NATO membership. Finland announced a similar decision one day earlier. Russia previously warned the two Nordic countries against joining the alliance, saying that could result in a nuclear buildup in the Baltic. Ukraine's military says it's working to evacuate all remaining troops from the southern port city of Mariupol, ceding full control to Russia after weeks of siege. The military has also announced an end to the combat mission in the city. On Monday, hundreds of Ukrainian forces, many of them wounded, were transferred to Russian-held towns. Moscow earlier said a deal had been reached to evacuate the injured troops. Some 600 soldiers and civilians were holed up in Mariupol's Azovstal steel plant for over 2 months as Russian forces took control of other parts of the city. Ukraine's deputy defense minister says that all of the evacuees will be subject to a potential prisoner exchange with Moscow. Meanwhile, Russia continues its airstrikes on Kyiv and Lviv near Poland's border. A series of blasts have hit Lviv a few hours ago, but so far no reports of casualties or damage. While the conflict in Ukraine continues, Johnny Miller has traveled to the Petrovsky district near the front line in Donetsk to investigate reports on the shelling of Donbas civilians by the Ukrainian army.
Petrovsky, a district of Donetsk. The front line is only a few kilometers away. The Ukrainian army has been shelling the district since 2014, and since the war with Russia began, the shelling has intensified. A school, two shells landed yesterday in the playground.
Yesterday in the morning, approximately from 8 until 9, two missiles hit here, from either Novomikhailovka or Krasnogorovka. You could hear some whistling and two explosions. One hit the big tree over there, another hit over here. And 18 windows in the school were damaged.
The janitor cleans up the glass from the shattered windows to the sound of outgoing artillery fired by the Donbas separatists.
The janitor at that school told us that another school had been hit just a few hours ago in Petrovsky, so we're going there now to see what damage has been done.
A branch blown off and shattered glass. It is fortunate the children here are currently learning from home.
I found some shrapnel, deadly pieces of shrapnel that will kill or injure anybody nearby. And it's strange here seeing people still walking about and looking out their windows. At any time, one of these missiles could hit them.
Another recent strike on an apartment building. Two people were confirmed killed. 20 meters away, children play. Since 2014, over 100 children have been killed by Ukrainian shelling and over 14,000 people in total. We hear of more shelling today on some houses.
No, my house was hit on 3rd of May. Not today. Not directly my house, but my fence was damaged by shrapnel. Today house number 30 was hit. Let's go.
A few houses along, another fence destroyed.
What happened? The shooting started and we couldn't understand where it was from. Then we heard a rustling sound. It was above our heads. It hit once, twice, the third, then the fourth hit here. I saw the smoke and thought there was a fire.
While thousands of people have left Petrovsky, many, like Yulia, prefer to stay. They have nowhere else to go and prefer living under shelling than becoming refugees.
What can I say? It happens often. There are many places hit, not only here, but near the roundabout, the big supermarkets, and people die every day. When will it end?
So, why do you not leave here?
Where should we go? It's our earth, our ground, our houses are here. Why should we go anywhere? We didn't go to shoot at anyone. We have always been here. For what reason they shoot at us?
It's difficult to explain just how strange it is here in Petrovsky district. The people who are still here are leaving their lives in the hands of God or chance. Every day there are dozens of missile strikes here. While it's quiet at the moment, there's usually the constant rumble of incoming and outgoing artillery. While the vast majority of shelling in this war is being done by Russia, who currently have air and artillery superiority, the uncomfortable truth is that Ukraine is also killing civilians. Indeed, as it sees it, its own civilians. And they have been doing so for the last 8 years. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
The EU foreign ministers failed to reach agreements on a sixth round of sanctions against Russia over the conflict in Ukraine. The latest tranche includes a proposal to ban imports of Russian oil to the EU, but Hungary is blocking the move over economic concerns. Jerome Hughes has more from Brussels.
The Hungarian government, led by Viktor Orban, is attracting scathing criticism from other EU nations. Citing an enormous economic impact, Orban is refusing to agree on an EU-wide ban on oil being imported from Russia. The impasse was discussed at length by EU foreign affairs ministers on Monday. They have agreed to send €500 million to Ukraine for weapons to fight Russia, bringing the total so far to €2,000 million. The EU's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, boasts that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the money spent by the EU on weaponizing Ukraine.
Apart from these 2,000 million, the member states do a lot from their side without asking for refunding.
Also on Monday, Borrell warned leaders from Western Balkans countries they will have no chance of joining the EU unless they toe the line.
To maintain close ties with the Putin regime is no longer compatible with building a common future with the European Union.
EU foreign ministers say it's essential that the bloc diversifies its energy supply chains. Experts point out that, after Russia, Iran has the world's second largest oil reserves.
If there is a comprehensive nuclear agreement, then slowly this definitely opens a window of opportunity to have supply lines with a country like Iran. Why not?
The cost of living across the 27-nation EU is rising by the day. Finland and Sweden look set to join NATO. The West continues to deliver weapons to Ukraine. There is massive uncertainty regarding energy security. Experts say the West has no interest in normalizing relations with Russia. For this reason, economists are warning things will almost certainly get much worse for EU citizens before they get better. Jerome Hughes at the Council of the EU, Brussels.
The European Commission has sharply revised down its economic growth forecast for both the European Union and the Eurozone for the year 2022. It has also doubled estimates for inflation compared to its February readings. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the matter with our guests.
Welcome to another edition of the News Review. Russia's war in Ukraine is taking a heavy toll on Europe's economy. The European Commission has now slashed its expectations for the Eurozone's growth while increasing its inflation forecast for the Monetary Union. The EU's executive arm cut the annual growth for both the bloc and the Eurozone to 2.7, blaming soaring energy prices. The figure is down from the previous forecast of 4%. It also predicted of that, consumer prices in the euro area will go up by 6.1% year on year. That is a near doubling of the previous forecast of 3.5%. The European Commission also hiked the expected inflation for the EU much higher than its earlier forecast. The Commission warned that the forecast is subject to high uncertainty and risks, noting that it could worsen further if Russia completely cuts off its oil and gas supplies to Europe. For more on that, we are joined by our correspondent Jerome Hughes, who is joining us live from Brussels, and also Rodney Shakespeare, professor of economics from London. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen. Let's begin with Jerome Hughes. Now, Jerome, these sanctions that were imposed by the European Union on Russia is now backfiring on Europeans themselves. And now we see in these economic reports, as I told you, the forecasts that are now being considered. Can you please tell us more about the economic situation that the Eurozone will be facing?
Indeed. Well, perhaps it's more practical and more beneficial to focus on what actually is happening as opposed to these forecasts, because I think there's a general consensus that the forecasts are not worth the paper they're written on. I mean, even a month ago, you'll remember Christine Lagarde, the head of the European Central Bank, which manages the euro currency. She said, you know, when asked about how bad could things go, she said, quote, who knows? So really, there's no way of knowing what could happen. But what we do know for sure is in the past year on year, energy prices in the Eurozone increased by 38% in April, and they've certainly increased since then. And to put a sort of a real example on that, if you bought 200 litres of home heating oil in April, it would cost €275. If you buy 200 litres of home heating oil today, it's going to cost €300. So it's even in 1 month, it's gone up by €25. And that's right across the board when you're talking about home heating oil, but you're talking about, you know, fuel for cars as well, and the knock-on impact as well, because a lot of the gas generates electricity, so electricity prices have gone up. So really, things are in a very bad they're in a very bad state as we speak. But these forecasts could be overly optimistic. There's no doubt about that, because as Christine Lagarde says, who knows what happens if Russia decides to cut off all of the gas supply
exactly.
to the EU.
Exactly. All of this is happening, Jerome, while Russia has not cut off its oil and gas supplies just yet. So let's bring in Rodney Shakespeare to see what will the European Union be looking at if that happens, Professor.
Well, this is weird. They've gone completely mad. There's more sense in Alice in Wonderland. You've asked me about Russia cutting off the supplies of oil and gas. Who is trying to cut off the supplies of Russian oil and gas? Who is sanctioning Russia in the endeavor to do this? And then talks about what happens if Russia cuts off the supplies of oil and gas. Their logic and their grasp of reality has absolutely collapsed. They're now in a mental state of trying to destroy Russia and to say and do anything. As regards these figures of growth, what growth? When your inflation is officially 6, it's really 12, going up to 15 or 20. In the UK today, they're talking about 10, it'll soon be 15 or 20. Where is the growth? Have any of these people even gone to the local supermarket and done any shopping? They are now saying and doing anything, and their minds are going around in a whirl of hatred. And they've lost control of the situation, and all I think can say is this is going to hit the people and the citizens of Europe. It's going to hit them worse and worse, and there is no solution to it coming from these elitists at this moment.
Thank you very much. That was Rodney Shakespeare, professor of economics from London, and also our correspondent Jerome Hughes from Brussels. Thanks to both of you gentlemen for sharing your views with us.
In an attempt to increase U.S. military engagements in Africa, Washington is set to redeploy troops to Somalia. President Joe Biden has approved the reposition of fewer than 500 ground forces to the East African country. Washington is seeking to justify the decision by claiming that intelligence suggests the terrorist group Al-Shabaab could soon pose a threat to the region's security. Biden's decision will reverse the withdrawal of 750 U.S. troops from Somalia in 2021 that was ordered by his predecessor Donald Trump. The Al-Qaeda-affiliated Al-Shabaab has been fighting against the Somalian government for more than a decade now, targeting both civilians and military personnel in bloody attacks. The Iranian foreign minister has condemned Israeli crimes against the Palestinians, including the desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Al-Quds. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said that Israel is a source of insecurity in the region. He made the remarks in a meeting with the new president of the United Arab Emirates, Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, in Abu Dhabi. Amir Abdullahian congratulated Sheikh Mohammed on his appointment as the UAE's new president. He expressed hope that the two countries' ties would grow in all areas. Sheikh Mohammed, for his part, called for the removal of obstacles in deepening bilateral relations, saying that regional issues should be resolved by the countries in the region. The heavy dust storm has forced the closure of schools, universities, and public offices across several Iranian provinces, including the capital, Tehran. The dust storm, originating from Iraq and Syria, entered Iran on Monday, blanketing eight provinces, mostly in the west. The concentration of fine dust particles in some cities is 20 times higher than safety levels. In neighboring Iraq, officials say that at least 4,000 people have swarmed hospitals with breathing problems. This is the eighth sandstorm to hit Iraq over the past month. A thick cloud of dust has enveloped the capital, Baghdad, in an orange glow, prompting the city's authorities to declare a day off for local government institutions. Baghdad International Airport has halted all flights and has closed its airspace until further notice. According to the UN, Iraq is the fifth most vulnerable country to climate crisis. And that does it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's guidelines for political activities of armed forces and said that he strongly warned these forces against involvement in political activities and membership in any political party or group due to the fact that it would undermine armed forces and ultimately harm the power of the country and the system. This week, we are going to discuss the situation of cinema in the pre-Islamic revolution era and touch upon Imam Khomeini's guidelines on the issue. Stay tuned, please. Cinema is a very important domain in culture and art of every country. Cinema entered Iran during the rule of King Muzaffaruddin of Qajar dynasty in 1890s. This art was not welcomed by ulema and religious strata due to its corrupt nature and the fact that it spread the European lifestyle. During the rule of Reza Khan in early 20th century, cinema found its way to other a few cities in addition to the capital, Tehran. Upon the fall of Reza Khan and excessive dependence of his son, Mohammad Reza, to the West, especially the U.S., hundreds of American films were screened. In those days, the U.S. started training of Iranian artists and filmmakers. In 1940s, from among 400 films that were screened in Iran, nearly 300 were American. After the U.S. staged coup d'etat in August 1963, the Iranian cinematic climate turned toward more profiteering and box office. Hence, entertaining films little by little found their way into Iran's cinema. In 1950s and 60s, pornographic films were gradually screened in some of the Iranian cinemas, particularly in Tehran. This corrupt trend continued till the end of the regime's life in Iran in 1979. During this period, the Pahlavi regime made every effort to screen anti-religious and pornographic films in every city, even religious cities like Qom and Mashhad. One of the researchers of cinematic issues categorizes the films of the era of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi in four groups. The first group included the films which would clearly ridicule religion. The second group composed the films of which portrayed religious themes like The Deluge and the story of Joseph and Zuleika in a deviated form. The third group was the films which used religion for mundane desires. Finally, the fourth group included few films which contained religious scripts. The Shah regime did its best to mislead young generation so that they would not have the time and motive to even think of the corruption prevailing everywhere in the country. In 1970s, clashes between cinema and religion reached their climax as the cinema had turned into a window for showing the Western corrupt movies. The ulema, led by Imam Khomeini, were strongly opposed to cinema of the Pahlavi regime as it had turned into a tool in the hand of the regime to push forward the American goals in the country. The Imam once said, "If a cinema is ethical and scientific, who will prevent it? But when we see that our country, from its cinema to its school, is colonialist, it means that these have been brought for us from abroad. They are the gifts that have been brought from there to corrupt our young generation and everything. If a mosque becomes such, we will close it too." The noble prophet demolished the Zarar Mosque. That we are opposed to cinema, it means We are opposed to such a cinema. Imam Khomeini writes in his testament, "Radio, TV, the press, cinemas, and theaters have been among effective tools of decadence and numbing of nations, especially the young generation. During the recent century, especially the second half, what big plots were designed with these tools for propagation against Islam and the serving clergy, and for promotion of the Western and Eastern colonialists. They were used for the markets of goods, particularly luxurious and decorative goods of every kind, from imitation in buildings and their decoration and luxury to imitation in drinks and clothing. If, God forbid, the servile and destructive Pahlavi regime had continued, every soon our dear youth would have been corrupt by various devilish conspiracies and schemes of the regime. Or they would have destroyed their youth period in the centers of corruption. Almighty God did a favor to us and them and rescued all from the mischief of the corrupt and the looters." Imam Khomeini, warning the statesman, writes elsewhere in his statement, "Have you forgotten the spread of indecency all over the country and in the centers of corruption, from the brothels to gambling houses, bars, cinemas, and other centers, each of which was a big factor for corrupting the young generation?" Dear listeners, next time we will continue the discussion.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The white gunman has killed 10 people and wounded 3 others. 11 other people who were shot were black. The gunman was an 18-year-old who wrote a white supremacist manifesto online. What can bring about hate in a white person so much to drive 200 miles to a black neighborhood and kill 10 people? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what police have described as a hate crime and why white-black tensions remain at a critically high level in the United States, including a review of other hate crimes that occur in that country. But first, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Professor of African American Studies at the University of Houston, Gerald Horn, joins us from Houston, Texas. Also joining us, editor of the Pan-African Newswire, Abayomi Azikiwe, who joins us from Detroit. Gentlemen, welcome to you both.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
So we're looking at an unprecedented incident that has taken place. It's really sad to see things like this happen time and again. Gerald Horn, let me first start with you. This has been categorized as a hate crime, and in my intro, I'm going to relay that question to you, of which, how much hate can a white person have for blacks, and in this case, to have so much hate to build up to commit such a horrific crime, driving 200 miles, and then kill 10 people as a result, and that could have been more.
We have a very seriously profound problem in the United States of America. And I think it's important for your audience to recognize that on the one hand, this is an elite phenomenon. That is to say, if you were able to tune into Fox News, one of the major cable networks in the United States today, which also has interests in Australia and in Britain, and in fact in India as well, you would hear the kind of rhetoric, the kind of language that helped to drive this sick, demented individual to slaughter all of these people in Buffalo. But at the same time, it's a mass phenomenon. In a few days, I'll have a book coming out on 19th century Texas where I point out that if you look at the liquidation of what we call the Indian population, the indigenous population of North America, it not only came from mandates from the top, it came from actions by poor European settlers who wanted to seize the land of the Indians. And likewise, you have a number of white American working class and middle class people today who are rather easily manipulated by this point that supposedly the reason they're not doing very well in the economic marketplace is not because of the elites bringing down $14 million, $15 million salaries on an annual basis, but because of the fact that black people are stealing their jobs, that Mexican Americans are stealing their jobs, that immigrants are stealing their jobs. Because we have both an elite problem and a mass problem, it makes it even more difficult to solve.
Well, looking at what was described as one of the things that this white male had in terms of, or is in terms of his character makeup, Abayomi Azikiwe, is that he was called a white supremacist. So naturally, looking at the definition, which you can tell us what that is exactly. But then looking deeper into this, came across a terminology that it was called replacement theory from one outlet, and then it seems like the more prevalent term is called white genocide. I'd like for you to put that into context for us, the difference there, because white genocide, I think the white supremacist falls under that, if I'm correct to understand it. Perhaps you can tell us, Abayomi Azikiwe.
Well, thank you. The white supremacist ideology is deeply rooted in United States history, its institutions. This was founded as a white supremacist state going all the way back to the British colonies, the Dutch colonies in the Northeast. So this is nothing new. These mass executions, lynchings have been carried out from the period of enslavement all the way through the post-Reconstruction period, all the way into the 20th century. If we look just over the last several years, Dylann Roof walked into a historic African-American church in Charleston, South Carolina, and killed a number of black people based upon the same delusional, racist, ideological issues. So this is continuing inside the United States. Racist was...
I'm going to get back to you, Abayomi. Let me get to Gerald Horn with this question about what is white supremacist and what is this white genocide, which is something that this particular person it was known to follow, which includes a whole variety of things, which basically is about how white replacement is being thrown about. Many call it a conspiracy theory, but this particular person and many others like him believe in that. Can you please tell us what white genocide is?
Well, this fallacy of white genocide is the idea that there is some sort of plot to reduce or replace the population that is defined as white by Mexican immigrants, by Haitian immigrants, by African immigrants. The problem is that from the inception of this settler state and the settler colonies going back to the 1500s, about 500 years ago, this has been a territory that has been populated not only by people of European descent, but by people of non-European descent. The difference was that historically, the people of non-European descent were treated in a third-class or fourth-class manner. But the issue is that over the centuries, we've been able to organize, and now we are only treated in a second-class manner. And many of those who are defined as white object to that. They think we should be treated in a fourth-class manner. And that leads to this idea of white genocide, the fact that they're not able to treat us as if we were in apartheid South Africa in 1949. And likewise, this idea that they are not able to prevail. They're not able to necessarily get every job that they want in competition with black people, for example. And of course, they consider the ultimate insult to be that black men oftentimes date or even marry women that are defined as white. And that is the nub of the question.
Taking a look at the stats that are out there, it's alarming that you have hate crimes that have increased, and it's at a 10-year high. I looked at the stats from the year 2019 to 2021, Abayomi, and it states that there were roughly a little over 7,300 hate crimes, up from 7,100, and the highest number recorded since the year 2008. Now, when you talk about hate crime, obviously blacks are targeted. It's the highest category. So the first question is, why are blacks targeted? Which then brings about the question about hate crimes, not just involving African Americans, but then you go into Asians, for example. They have now turned up to be somewhat at the top. And then, of course, you have Latinos in there. And then we can go, of course, into categories like Muslims and Jews. So what's going on? First, why are blacks at the top of the list here?
Well, if you look at the history of the United States, the ruling class in this country was largely built as a result of the expropriation of African labor during enslavement. And even during the post-enslavement period, there's still the super exploitation of African labor. We also see it in those communities that are of Latin American descent, Asian American descent, and hate crimes are escalating against all people of color communities. In part, it has to do with, as well, the changing demographics of the United States, the fact that people of color communities are growing in regard to their proportion of the overall U.S. population. And many of these people tend to vote non-Republican, they tend to vote Democratic, but the Democratic Party does not have a program that can encompass their needs based upon their social status. So eventually, these people of color communities and other communities in the United States will break with the Democratic Party. And of course, when that happens, there is the propensity for even greater racial conflict in the United States. We saw in 2021 with the attempted right-wing coup at the aegis of former President Donald Trump. And there's a whole movement out there that is really an extension of the Ku Klux Klan and other white supremacist organizations that arose during the post-Civil War period. And these were rich, wealthy whites that formed the Ku Klux Klan. People like Nathan Bedford Forrest, who made a fortune as a slave trader. He was a general in the Confederate Army, and he was one of the founders of the Ku Klux Klan. So these policies come directly from the ruling elites here in the United States. So. And they're going to continue, and unfortunately, they're going to worsen in the years to come.
It's interesting, Gerald Horn, that our guest there says that. the fact that it's going to worsen, because I just talked about some demographics. So then what's left really are the whites, aside from the ones that I mentioned. But then even within the whites, there are there are frictions. For example, in Boston, if you go to the Harvard area, as opposed to the people who are over the river, there's clashes there in terms of just culture not mixing. And I'm talking whites within whites. So what's the big picture in the U.S.? I mean, multiculturalism obviously has failed, and yet it's gotten to a boiling point and crisis mode as we see incidents like this happen where you have this white person come out and kill 10 African Americans.
Well, you have to realize that for decades now, the U.S. ruling elite has fought a very bitter struggle against the very idea of class solidarity. That is to say, working class people who are the majority and come from various ethnic and racial backgrounds uniting in order to get higher wages and better working conditions. Because of this war against working class solidarity, you've had the proliferation, I'm afraid to say, particularly in the population that's defined as white, of a certain kind of racial and ethnic chauvinism. Indeed, it's not accidental, I'm afraid to say, that this massacre took place in Buffalo. Just a few months ago, you had a Democrat who also defined herself as a socialist, who was on the verge of being elected mayor of Buffalo, but the elites in the Democratic Party were afraid that her policies would lead to a redistribution of wealth from the top to the bottom, and they schemed to derail her candidacy and to make sure that she was. Likewise, if you look at the U.S. president, Joseph R. Biden, who cares about this racist massacre, recall that in the early 1970s, he got his start as a politician by campaigning and crusading against the very idea that there should be school desegregation by using buses. Supposedly, he was against the bus, but as Reverend Jesse Jackson, a leader in this country, might have said at that time, he was actually against us. That is to say, he was whipping up hysteria amongst the so-called white majority in order to deflect attention away from the fact that those at the top of the socioeconomic pyramid, speaking of the 1% of the society, are making out like bandits at the expense of the white working class, and in fact, at the expense of the entire working class.
Sure. Well, it's very interesting how blacks are being targeted, or African Americans, I should say, Abiyomi Ezekiwe, because the analysis drawn from that from some is the fact that the white, and I'm talking very generally, so pardon me for putting it this way, but I have a reason for that, because some are saying and deducting or analyzing, saying that, you know, the whites want to hold supremacy. I say that, and I want to put this next to this particular stat, which came out in the year 2019, that the cost of racism in the U.S. economy is costing the U.S. economy $16 trillion. 16. One figure from another source has put it at $50 trillion because of discrimination, and African Americans is part of that, including Latinos and people of color. If the U.S. government acknowledges this, which Biden did during his run as a president, when he was running for presidency, why isn't it doing anything about it? Why is it still continuing then, the issue of racism, to the degree that it is costing the government so much money?
Well, costing the government money is contingent upon what type of society we have in the United States. Racism, the super exploitation of labor of African people and other people of color communities is very profitable to the ruling interests in the United States. Disrupting that system would better the living conditions for the majority of people inside the United States. There's this divide, of course, between those who seek to bring about a broader democratic dispensation and those who want to narrow the dispensation to only include white males. And we see this in many different political debates taking place inside the United States. At this time, the U.S. is undergoing a very turbulent economic period with hyperinflation that we haven't seen in the last 40 years. And this is going to have a disproportionate impact on African Americans and people from the Latino community, as well as working class whites. So interjecting these hate messages in the white community to make it appear as if black people and brown people and indigenous people and Asian people, Muslims, women are taking away something that should be by right belonging to white men is a very dangerous ideology. And I don't think the growing people of color community inside the United States is going to tolerate this in the long term. African Americans have struck back against racist violence, and they will continue to do so. And it remains to be seen if these whites who are attempting to move the United States that far to the right will be successful. It's really open to question whether they will be or not, because in doing that, they're going to have to move against a great number of their own people.
Okay, so are we at that point, Gerald Horn, or have we passed it where we're going to see some kind of uprising? We see the protest happening when you have police brutality cases that involve, for example, a white police officer and how he has killed an African-American. We've seen that incident a number of times. But has it reached the crisis point where the uprising is going to be in large numbers and masses in the U.S.?
Well, that's one option. That is to say, a mass uprising that will beat back thoroughly and decisively the racists. Another option, I'm afraid to say, is the option of U.S. fascism. I would dare say that there are the seeds of fascism in the United States as we speak, based upon the point, as already has been mentioned, that the United States was built as a settler society involving liquidation of the Native Americans and expropriation of the labor of the Africans. However, I will also say that just as this racist terrorist in Buffalo received aid and comfort from abroad, the idea of replacement theory that he was spouting actually is an import from France that has been adapted in the United States. I think also that the fascists can be defeated, the terrorists can be defeated with international solidarity. Because keep in mind that if these fascists actually gain more power in the United States today than they wield at this particular moment, it will not only be people of color and black people in particular who are treated atrociously, this will inevitably be exported. That has been the lesson of US, the United States. That is to say, the problems in the United States do not necessarily stay inside of the United States. Inevitably, they're exported abroad, which is one of the reasons of why I would make an urgent and passionate call to our friends in Iran to rally to our defense, because this would not only be an act of charity on your part towards people struggling against dehumanization in the United States of America, it would be in your own self-interest as well.
Sure. It's interesting you use the terminology, dehumanization. But what was also very interesting, which I think is going to be the last question here, Abiyomi Azikiwe, is one of the things that this 18-year-old mentioned that he got his idea for doing and executing what he did was from the Brenton Harrison Tarrant case in Australia, in which you had him, you know, doing that live streaming and killing 51 people. And of course, this was in a mosque and Muslims were targeted. I mentioned before that there are Jewish people that fall on this, under this white supremacy, which some call conspiracy, of which they're saying that you know what, there's a plan that whites are being eliminated. Are there going to be? Is there a social crisis that the U.S. is engulfed in, where you have different demographics that may be you know, fighting each other? When you see cases like what we just what we have witnessed with the killing of these 10 people, African Americans?
Most definitely. All you have to do is live in a U.S. city, whether it is a majority African American. I live in Detroit, or in other cities like New York City, Los Angeles, Seattle, and you can see the growing class divisions. You can see the racial polarization that is taking place. And unfortunately, neither of the two dominant political parties inside the United States has any program to address these issues.
They are being allowed. They do or they don't.
Yeah, they're allowing these problems to continue to escalate. And as long as they escalate, it's going to worsen the capacity of the United States to act. in any type of unified fashion, and it's just going to worsen the overall social conditions inside the United States.
Okay.
And
I can give Gerald Horne 30 seconds there. Gerald Horne, so you said that Iran could help, but let's put the context domestically. In your capacity, what can you do, and what would you advise others in order to stop this crisis that the U.S. is experiencing between different classes?
Well, the elephant in the room is the proliferation of weapons. It was quite simple and easy for this terrorist to buy a weapon, even though he explicitly said that it could be used to kill human beings. Unfortunately, there is a logjam in Congress with regard to circumscribing the sale of weapons. If you don't want to circumscribe the sale of weapons, of course, you could circumscribe the sale of bullets. But unfortunately, there's no political will for either.
Thank you very much for that, Gerald Horne there, professor of African American Studies at the University of Houston. Thank you for your thoughts. And editor of the Pan-African Newswire, Abiyomi Azikiwe from Detroit. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Ikaba Tahwe and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, dear listeners from all around the world, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to another edition from a series of Q&A in Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. Like always, we have invited a scholar from Qom Seminary Schools, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, to the show to help us answer the questions that we pose in this series of shows. Usually, we are trying to answer doubts or misconceptions in Islamic beliefs. The doubts which have been asked by different questioners from around the world. The question of the day is about the revelation of the Holy Quran. And it has been asked that why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has not revealed the Holy Quran earlier than the dawn of Islam. Because all of us know that the Quran has been revealed to the Holy Prophet, to the heart of the Holy Prophet, at the dawn of Islam. So if we believe that this is a comprehensive book, why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala actually refrained from revealing it at the very beginning of the creation, at the time that he created Adam, alayhi salam? This is a question that we need to ask it from respected guest speaker, Sheikh Nur Muhammad. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure, Sheikh. So the question is that why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala actually revealed this Quran so late. So could it be earlier? I mean, could Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bring this comprehensive book from the beginning of the creation So what was the reason that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala brought so many books that we believe that they were not complete books, right, and not as comprehensive as the Holy Quran, and reach to this level that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala at the end of the time, let's say at the end of the Prophet, revealed it to the Holy Prophet of Islam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Can you give the book of a university student to the elementary school?
No.
Of course not. Rationally speaking, it is not acceptable, because a boy in the elementary school cannot recognize and cannot understand books in university levels.